Welcome to Ask Margot, our radio program where we address the sticky questions of life in order to find real solutions. I'm Margot de Coatsworth and I'm your host today. We welcome your questions and we cover everything from health and longevity to relationships, success, finding love, keeping love, all the big things that matter. Last time we spoke about the blue zones, those regions of the world where people live exceptionally long lives, and the research project that analysed how those communities live and what enables such longevity. I've thought about it a lot since then and talked to many people, and thinking about my own lifestyle, just how that compares to what they suggest we should be doing. I mentioned that we would return to discuss not just the three broad themes that they distilled about longevity, but to what they call the full power nine, the nine lifestyle habits identified in the Blue Zones research. So here they are. Number one, move naturally. Daily gentle movement built into life. Walking, gardening, cooking, carrying. And yes, walking includes going uphill, which some of us are reluctant to do. But that natural, consistent movement seems to be a key in longevity. Number two, purpose. Having a reason to get up in the morning. The Japanese call this ikigai, your reason for being. Purpose gives energy. It gives direction. Number three, downshift. That's an interesting word. I haven't heard that before. It simply means finding regular ways to reduce stress. That might be a nap, prayer, social time, rituals. It might be turning the lights down, lighting a candle, reading a book, or watching a fire. I find that quite mesmerizing. Small, intentional ways to calm your nervous system. Number four, the 80% rule. Stop eating when you're about 80% full. Not stuffed, not uncomfortable, just satisfied. Number five, plant slant. Mostly eat plant-based foods, especially beans and pulses. Beans are extraordinarily nutritious, and in the West, we tend not to focus nearly enough on those in our diet. Number six, wine at five. I did not add this one in. Yes, that is part of the research. Moderate amounts, usually with food and friends. Of course, it's not essential, but it is common in blue zone communities. Number seven, belong. A spiritual or community connection seems to be a major factor. Somewhere you feel anchored, a place and people. Number eight, loved ones first. Strong family bonds are required. Time and energy invested in relationships rather than just possessions. When you see estates being auctioned, full of things, I can't help but hope that those lives were rich in people as well as objects collected. Because when you go, they're gone. And you leave people behind with something of yourself. And finally, number nine, the right tribe. This is an interesting one. Social circles that support healthy behaviour. People you can relax with, talk to, laugh with, and who make healthy living normal rather than exceptional. So yes, the last time we summarised this into three broader categories: how we move, how we eat, and how we live socially and emotionally. But these nine habits sit underneath those themes. They are specific practices that allow people not just to live longer, but to live better. I do sponsor my own show here, I guess because I believe in it. So I think it's okay for me to occasionally have a little mention of my work. On LinkedIn, I talk about perfect health and longevity under the banner of Live Long and Prosper. I write articles and posts there. So if you ever want more on that subject, you can look me up on LinkedIn for posts and for articles. I also write about the word there, the universal interchange that I finish every episode with. The word is on Mondays and perfect health on Fridays. Unless there's a baby being hatched in my family, which was the case this week. We have another little addition to our clan and her name is Sienna. Now, our question today came up. The first one is about love. Is love on its own enough to sustain a relationship, even when the person you love may not treat you with respect, may not truly like you, or may not yet be ready to live in a healthy, meaningful partnership? Oh, you can probably tell I'm going to say no. Love on its own is not enough. We have romanticized love, or love romanticizes itself, as though it's the whole story, but it's not. Love is powerful, yes, it's moving, intoxicating, and deeply felt, but it's only one part of what makes a relationship viable. You can love someone and not actually like them. You can feel devotion, attachment, longing, and still find their character, their habits, or their values do not sit well with you. Love and liking are not identical. When you have both, it's great. When you have love without liking, something essential is missing. And then there's respect. Attention, everybody, this is important. If someone claims to love you but does not treat you with respect, does not consider you, does not hold you in high regard, does not behave in a way that honors your dignity, then that's not a complete form of love. It may be emotion, it may be desire, it may be dependency, it may even be control, but it's not the kind of love that nurtures or sustains. If it's love at all, it's a crummy kind and you don't want it. Love without respect will not support you. If you're not more with someone than you are without them, why would you go there? And if you find yourself already in a situation like that, you must look beyond the sparkle of the beginning. At the start of a relationship, we're all charming. We're attentive. We put our best foot forward. The question is not who someone is when they're trying to win you. The question is who they are when life settles into an ordinary rhythm. And also when pressure is on, which will happen. Love must be accompanied by liking, by respect, and by consistent behavior that reflects both. Anything less may feel intense, but it's not the best you can have. Hope that helps. Number two, I had a question from Julia the other day who said, I'm in a committed relationship, but part of me feels that even though my partner loves me, he doesn't really know me. If someone asked him deep questions about me, I don't think he could answer them. What do you think? Is this something to be concerned about, Margot? I don't think it's necessarily something to be concerned about, Julia, but I do think it's something worth addressing. There are three things I believe we need to know about the person we are committed to. First, what really moves them? What matters deeply to them? What touches them? I would want someone to know that about me, wouldn't you? Secondly, what motivates them? What are the driving factors in their life? What gets them out of bed? That's back to that purpose that we were talking about earlier. Lack of purpose and motivation in life takes you nowhere. You'll be where you are now if you hitch your train to theirs and they don't have purpose. In any relationship, you want someone to encourage you to grow yourself and not to hold you back. An unmotivated person will do that by default. They will hold you back. Thirdly, what lights them up? What do they aspire to? What excites them? What turns them on? To happiness, to possibility. This may at first sound like the previous one on what motivates them, but actually This is about the things that light you up, make you happy. It might be dancing, it might be nature, it might be quality friendships or music or a pursuit of some kind, something they really need in their lives to feel happy and satisfied. My suggestion is that you have a gentle conversation that touches on those three things, Julia. You might begin by asking him those questions about himself, and it'll be interesting for you to see whether what you think about him is accurate as well. You could even make a game of it. Each of you could write down on a piece of paper, what do you think moves me? What do you think motivates me? What do you think lights me up? Then you could do the same for him. Swap papers, read them out loud, see what's accurate and what might still be discovered. Do it on your next date, a discovery date night. Make it candlelit, keep it light. Don't approach it as though someone has fallen short. That will only close a door. I'll be very interested to know how that goes. Our next question is about doubt. We all deal with doubt. Last week we talked about how we should doubt our doubts and believe our beliefs, not doubt our beliefs and believe our doubts. But when we're faced with doubt, worry, concern, that jumpy feeling about something, how do we deal with it? How do we get on top of it? How do we master it in our lives? All of us at some point have to deal with this. It is a big question, and there are ways to handle it well. The first place to start is with who you are and how you see yourself. We always need to start there with any question or problem. If you see yourself as a person of inestimable value, not perfect, not infallible, but inherently worthy, then doubt loses some of its power. Why? Because doubt thrives in uncertainty about your own worth and capacity. When you anchor to a strong sense of self, doubt becomes information, not domination. Never domination. You are the boss of you, remember? You are the genie in your life. So here are some ways to master doubt. Separate it from identity. Doubt says something about what you're thinking, not who you are. You are not a doubtful person. You are someone who is encountering uncertainty. That's a mental shift that reduces the emotional weight of doubt. Studies in cognitive psychology show that separating thoughts from yourself reduces anxiety and increases clarity. It's a thing you are dealing with. It's not who you are. When doubt arises, ask yourself, is this belief based on evidence or just fear? Is it future projection or is it present reality? Is this doubt helping me solve a problem or just looping in my mind? This approach, used in cognitive behavioral therapy, turns rumination into inquiry. That's a good thing. Act anyway. Action is the antidote to paralysis, and doubt often thrives in inaction. Break your goals or your next steps into micro steps and just do one thing and then the next thing. Feel the result. Doubt diminishes when behavior outpaces fear. Research shows that even small actions reduce uncertainty and build momentum, and momentum reduces doubt. Practice self-compassion. People who treat themselves harshly when they doubt usually increase doubt. Self-compassion, the practice of speaking to yourself as kindly as you would to a friend, reduces emotional intensity and fosters resilience. Use evidence from your past where you have overcome doubt. Just remind yourself of those occasions. Doubt often sounds like fear. What if I fail? But you can reframe that as curiosity. What can I learn from trying? Curiosity engages the learning parts of the brain. Fear engages the avoidance parts. Different neural circuits, different outcomes. Beyond all of this, the right place to start is with who you believe yourself to be. The opposite of doubt is rooted in identity. That's where doubt that sounds like, I'm not ready, I can't do this, what if I fail, I'm not good enough, can be turned around using I am statements with intention, such as, I'm capable, I am learning, I am steady, I am resilient, I am able to figure this out, I am someone who follows through. Do you feel the energy in those statements? It's so good. Research in cognitive psychology shows that repeated self-statements shape your internal belief structures. The brain responds to language as instruction. That's your genie listening. When you consistently rehearse an identity, you reinforce neural pathways that make that identity more accessible in moments of stress. It means you're choosing deliberately. If doubt says, I'm not enough, you respond with, actually, I'm more than enough. If doubt says, I'm not ready, you respond with, I'm so ready. Because the opposite of doubt is self-trust. You don't eliminate doubt by fighting it. You master it by strengthening your identity. Doubt questions who you are, and your I am statements answer it. So that's how you rise above doubt, not by denying it, but by defining yourself more clearly than it can. Did you notice that I use the word jumpy rather than anxious? That's a deliberate choice on my part, because jumpy seems more acceptable, a bit lighter to me. And I never use the word anxious, because it's so loaded these days. If you say, I'm feeling jumpy about something, it just seems lighter and easier to manage. Don't allow yourself to label yourself as something that you don't want. Don't say to yourself, my anxiety stops me from going on a date or leaving the house or dancing or applying for a new job. If you don't want it, why would you call it my anxiety? Every time you hear yourself identifying yourself with something you don't want, immediately, absolutely turn it around. Don't say, my illness, my cancer, my whatever it is that you don't want. Because if you say it, you are identifying with it. This is really important. Only own the things you want. Only say my if you want it. Because you're claiming it when you do that. Scientifically, metaphysically, energetically, logically, mentally, biologically, and in every other way, this is so important. This is what we all need to change in life in order to get the things we want and not be living with the stuff we don't. Okay, I think I've covered that one. Our next question. I try to remember the five love languages and then I can't. Is there an easy way to remember them? That's from Richard. And interestingly enough, here's a fun one that you might like. A friend sent me this, the five love languages in burrito speak. Words of affirmation. This is a good burrito. Acts of service. I made you a burrito. Receiving gifts. Here's a burrito. Quality time. Let's go and get some burritos together. Physical touch. Arms wrapped around your person in a big hug, just like a burrito. It's silly, of course, but it works. And sometimes we remember things better when we don't take them too seriously. Now, here's the important part. Our default position in love is to think about what makes us feel loved and then do that for our other person. We assume that what fills our tank must fill theirs. That's where we go wrong. We have to stop doing that, even though it's not easy. Instead, Look at the person in front of you. Watch what they instinctively do for you. How do they show up? What do they naturally offer? Do they do little things to make your life easier? Put the rubbish out, clear and set the table, fold the washing, or pack something for your lunch. If their love comes in practical gestures and quiet helpfulness, then that's acts of service. That's how they express love. That's how you'll connect with them, by doing something that ticks that same box for them. If it's words of affirmation, if they're constantly telling you how well you did, how good you look, how capable you are, how you smell great, that's their language. They're saying, "I see you," and they will respond deeply when you speak the same language back to them. Physical touch is about connection. It's about putting your arm around someone, linking arms, holding hands, sitting close. Small, steady contact. If that's what they offer you, that's what makes them feel secure and loved in return. Receiving gifts. That one can be misunderstood. It isn't about extravagance. It might be a flower, a favorite treat, a book you mentioned, a piece of jewelry, even something small and thoughtful. If they're always bringing you something, they're saying, "I thought of you." That's their love language. Even if gift giving isn't a priority for you, try this. Watch how they light up when you give them something that says, "You were on my mind." And finally, quality time. If they're always saying to you, "Come and sit with me," or "Let's go for a walk," or "Can we just have some time together?" If what they want most is your presence, then that's their language. If you're someone who's busy flitting from one thing to the next, you will have to make a deliberate effort to stop. Put the phone down, turn towards them, be there. That will make them feel seen. That will make them feel loved. The key is simple. Notice what they do. That's the clue. Love is just not about feeling. You need to be an interpreter. And when you learn to speak their language, even if it's not your native tongue, connection becomes much easier. Our next question is an extension of this. It comes from something I heard from Jefferson Fisher, which I think is quite profound, so I wanted to acknowledge him. He says, "How do you really know what makes someone tick? How do you see past the surface?" Here's a simple way to begin. Don't just listen to what they talk about. Listen to what they brag about. Listen to what they complain about. And listen to what they laugh about. Bragging reveals what someone truly treasures. When people boast, even subtly, they're telling you what they admire in themselves. Is it kindness? Is it hard work? Is it status? Is it influence? Is it money? Is it integrity? Whatever they elevate publicly is usually what they privately prize. It's very interesting. Think about those closest to you. What do they toot their horn about? Complaining. It shows what they think they deserve. If someone constantly complains about not being recognized, not being promoted, not being appreciated, that tells you something. If they complain about unfairness, inefficiency, laziness, disrespect, that reveals their standards and expectations. It tells you what they believe is owed to them and sometimes what they feel deprived of. And what someone laughs about, that reveals their heart. Humor is rarely neutral. What a person finds funny tells you what they are comfortable diminishing. Do they laugh at cruelty, at arrogance, at foolishness, absurdity, at any shared human experience? Laughter shows where their empathy lies or doesn't. Most people can curate what they say they believe. They can give you the polished version, but bragging, complaining, and laughing are less rehearsed. They are windows. If you want to understand someone, not just socially, but structurally, pay attention to those three things. Well, we're near the end of our show, and that is our last question for today. Thank you for your fine company. And don't forget, if you have a question, you can send it in to admin@coastaccessradio.org.nz or to me at margounlimited.com under the contact tab. Margot has a T at the end. We'll finish as usual with the word, our message from the universe for today. And remember, till next time, you are the genie and you hold the power to grant your own wishes. Here's the word. Just relax. Let go of your constraints and tension. Allow yourself to fall back into the wide, open, expansive arms that are there behind you to hold you and to catch you as you let go and fall into the expansiveness that is yours by right. You have no need to fear or worry. There is no fear or worry that actually exists other than in your fearing and worrying. It's like a hologram that has no substance. Only you give it substance if you believe it has substance. Your reality and your truth as you choose it to be. Choose beliefs that serve you. Choose the things that free you. Just relax and let go of your constraints and tension. Allow yourself to fall back into the wide, open, expansive arms that are there behind you to hold you and to catch you as you let go and fall into the expansiveness that is yours by right. You have no need to fear or worry. There is no fear or worry that actually exists other than in your fearing and worrying. It is like a hologram that has no substance. Only you give it substance if you believe it has substance. Your reality and your truth is as you choose it to be. Choose beliefs that serve you. Choose the things that free you. Thank you for joining me today.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.